Hello.
Hello.
Hi. My name is Danica, and I'm an alcoholic.
Hello.
Welcome to Wacky Paw 15 in Las Vegas. Wacky Paw is the Western Area Conference of Young People and Alcoholics Anonymous. Please help me open this meeting with a serenity prayer. God, grant me the serenity to accept the things I cannot change, courage to change the things I can, and the wisdom to know the difference. The topic of this panel meeting is medicine, psychiatry, and religion, and I have now asked Carolyn to read a passage from AA literature related to the topic.
Hi, my name's Carolyn. I'm an alcoholic.
Hey, Carolyn.
In chapter 2, page 19 of the Big Book, Bill Wilson writes, "Of necessity, there will have to be discussion of the matters medical, psychiatric, social, and religious. We are aware that these matters are, from their very nature, controversial. Nothing would please us as much to write a book which would contain no basis for content or argument. We shall do our utmost to achieve the ideal. Most of us sense that real tolerance of other people's viewpoints in respect of their opinions are attitudes which make us useful to others. Our very lives as ex-problem drinkers depend upon our constant thoughts of others and how we may help their needs." In the pamphlet, Problems Other Than Alcohol, Bill Wilson writes, "Perhaps there is no suffering more horrible than drug addiction, especially the kind which produced by morphine, heroin, and other narcotics. Such drugs twist the mind, and the awful process of withdrawal racks the sufferer's body." In chapter 6, page 87 of the Big Book, Bill Wilson writes, "If circumstances warrant, we ask our wives or friends to join us in the morning meditation. If we belong to a religious organization which requires morning devotion, we attend that also. If not members of religious bodies, we sometimes select and memorize a few set prayers which emphasize the principles we have been discussing. There are many helpful books, too. Suggestions about these may be obtained by from one's priest, minister, or rabbi. Be quick to see where religious people are right. Make use of what they have to offer." On page 575 of the Big Book, written in concept number 12 regarding how our service structure should operate, Bill Wilson writes, "That is, never perform acts of government, and that, like the society it serves, it will remain democratic throughout and action." The following is not found in AA literature, but was written by an AA member. The majority of ideas and actions that have been put together of the Fellowship and Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous were taken from men and women outside AA. Without help of men and women from medicine, religion, psychiatry, and yes, politics, our whole AA fellowship and society would never have been built. Tradition 10 tells us, Alcoholics Anonymous has no opinion on outside issues, hence the AA name ought never be drawn into public controversy. Please keep in mind that this is how AA is to deal with public and with other AA groups. Medicine, religion, psychiatry, and specific social organizations are written all over AA-approved literature and proved to be an inside issue. Some of the greatest men in psychiatry, medicine, and religion have concluded that they may have little impression upon the whole when combating alcoholism. Sorry. We have taken from the solution. Threefold, which has revolutionized the treatment of alcoholism, became to revolutionize society as well. Please remember that we must cooperate. But not... but not affiliate with organizations outside of AA. We are all in this together to help each other stay sober and help amend the destruction we have placed on society. Also, keep in mind that unless schooled in specific areas of expertise, we are strongly suggested to keep our opinions to ourselves regarding things of which we have no actual experience or teachings.
Now, I would like to welcome our first speaker, Jen F. from Sacramento, California.
Hi, guys. I'm Jen. I'm an alcoholic.
Hi, Jen.
I know. I love you guys, too. All right. So, Let's just start at the beginning, what happened, what it's like, and what it's like now. I took my first drink at 14. I didn't get drunk, like, the first time I drank. But the first time I drank, I had that, like that sense of, like, peace and comfort, and I was pretty, and I could talk to people, and, like, everything was okay. And, like, for a long time, like, I didn't feel okay in my skin, and, like, alcohol absolutely gave me that. So I chased that for a really long time. I drank at every opportunity that I could. I was a blackout drinker from the very beginning. I was just off, like, ripping and running. I was a freshman hanging out with seniors in high school, and it was fun to get the little freshman drunk. My nickname freshman year was Lush. And I don't really remember a lot. Like, I drank and I partied, and whatever I could get my hands on, like, I put it inside of me to, like, feel better and not have to feel. Like, I didn't want to feel my feelings. And, like, drugs are absolutely a part of my story. 'Cause it didn't matter. It didn't matter what the substance was for me. As long as it made me feel different and or not feel or feel better or whatever, like, I was on. Like, whatever you had, like, I did it. And I got, in high school, like, I have a lot of weird health stuff. I have migraines, and I've got crooked hips, so I got lots of weird pains and stuff. So in high school, it was really easy for me to go to the doctor and to get prescribed medication. And I took prescription pills for a long time. And I remember, like, being in class in high school and feeling uncomfortable and making that phone call to my doctor and being like, I hurt really bad. I need to come in right now. And like, I would go, and my mom would take me. And like, it was okay because it was prescribed. Even though I didn't take it as prescribed, I thought that was normal. Like, I thought that was what you did. Like, the doctor gives you pills and you just take them, like, as many as you want. And it was okay to get high on them. And I didn't know that normal people didn't do that. So I did that for a long time. Like, I did other drugs as well. I somehow managed to graduate high school. I don't really know how that happened. Right after we graduated high school, I was doing, in my senior year of high school, I was doing some sort of substance every single day. And I had a best friend that I partied with all the time. And when we graduated high school, for about a month, she disappeared. And I didn't know where she went. And then she came back, and she told me that she had got caught doing what we were doing, and she got sent to rehab. And that she was sober, and that she was going to these meeting things. And I didn't really understand it. The only thing I knew is that I missed my best friend. And so, like, in my mind, I was like, well, I partied as hard as you did, and I did all the same things as you did, so I need to get sober, too, and I need to go to meetings, too, but really I just wanted to hang out with my best friend. And so, like, I did. Like, I went to another program, and I started going to meetings. I was 18 years old. I'm going to meetings every day. I got a sponsor because that's what my best friend did. She got a sponsor, and she's working these step things. So I got a sponsor and was working steps, and I didn't understand any of it, but I did it. And I stayed sober for about 3 months, and I did steps 1, 2, and 3. And I was in college at that time. And I was working in a restaurant, and I was hanging out with, like, people that I worked with that were partying, and I was going to these parties, and people were drinking, and nobody really understood why I didn't drink. And then it got to the point where I didn't understand why I didn't drink. And I was 18 years old. Like, I got a drink on my 21st birthday. I got a drink champagne at my wedding. Like, there's all of these, like, things that I have to do that include drinking, and if I'm not drinking, like, those things aren't going to be fun. And so eventually, like, I drank again, and I drank for the next 6 years, and it was the same thing. I was blackout drinking all the time. I was using other substances, whatever it was, like, I would do it. And, like, prescription pills are a big part of my story because they were super easy for me to get. I would go to the emergency room all of the time, and to like the little clinics and stuff, and claim I had migraines when I didn't. I just wanted to get loaded, and I would get shots of things, and I would get prescribed pills, and I would mix those pills with alcohol and the other drugs I was doing. And I did that for a long time. I somehow, again, managed to graduate college. Again, I don't know how that happened. I was pretty functional for a long time, and that's kind of the way that I was raised. Like, I was raised where you keep, as long as you keep everything looking good on the outside, as long as you have the job, the car, the house, it doesn't matter what your insides look like, and it doesn't matter what you're doing. As long as you can keep your stuff together, like, you know, it doesn't matter. And nobody once ever told me that I had a problem. Nobody once ever told me, oh, I think you drink too much. Oh, you're doing too many drugs. You're not taking those pills as prescribed. And because I was really good at hiding it. I had a roommate. I was out of college for a couple years. I was about 24 years old, and I had a roommate that was totally normal. Like, she could have one beer. She could do one line, and I totally didn't get it. I'm like, what is the point? you know? And so, like, I had got myself into a really expensive habit, and I worked a really good job, and I found it necessary to dance on the weekends in order to support this habit. It was a couple hundred dollar a day habit, and it was the way I always swore to myself that, like, I would never stick a needle in my arm, and, like, it got to the point where the way that I was doing things wasn't working anymore. And so, like, I got to that point where I was like, it was a good idea. It was a good idea to stick a needle in my arm because it would work. Like, it would kill those feelings inside because nothing else was working. So that's what I was doing every day for about 2 months. I was working every single day. I was sticking needles in my arm every single day. And it got to the point where I was exhausted. Like, I was so tired. And my roommate had no idea. And we went out this one night, just girls' night. And we were drinking before, and, like, we had some party favors. She didn't know I had my own party favors that I was doing in the bathroom by myself. I spent a lot of time in the bathroom. And so we go out to this club, and we come back, and we get some more party favors. And, like, I was so delusional in my head. And we were sitting at our table. We partied at my kitchen table a lot and played dominoes. And we were sitting at the table, and I was like, look, dude, I was like, I'm exhausted. I was like, I'm tired of lying to you. I was like, this is what I'm doing, and this is how I'm doing it, and I'm just going to do it right in front of you. And she looks at me, and she's like, that is disgusting. I don't want to hang out with you anymore. And she goes to bed. And I was like, that did not go the way that I thought it was going to go. And so, but it was cool for me because we had all these new party favors and I didn't have to share them with her. So I did all of those that whole night in my bathroom by myself with my dog staring at me. He stared at me a lot and didn't understand what I was doing. And like, it was like the next morning, and I was still up, and I was supposed to be in the Bay for some family function, something that I missed again. And I was sitting there, and like, my arm, like, it wouldn't stop bleeding. Like, I had messed it up pretty bad, and it just wouldn't stop bleeding. And I was sitting there on my bathroom floor, and I had this like out-of-body experience almost, where I could, like, see myself. It was like that pitiful and incomprehensible demoralization. And I was like, how the heck did I get here? How did I get here? Like I came from a loving family. Like, I went to college. I have a job, a car, a house. I have all this stuff. Like, this is not supposed to be me. Like, I'm not supposed to be some crazy girl sticking needles in her arm. And I started crying, and I went into my roommate's room, and I asked her for help. And because I had gotten sober like 6 years before, I knew where to go. And so she helped me look for meetings, and we found a meeting, and she went to a meeting with me, and I ended up in the wrong meeting. And it was an AA meeting, and I was trying to go to another meeting. So there's God right there. Like, God brought me to my first AA meeting, and I don't remember much about that meeting. But I remember, like, getting introduced to this group of young people. And I had a DUI at the time, so I didn't drive. And they came to my house every single day, and they picked me up for meetings every single day. And I got a sponsor, and I started working steps again, and I had friends, and I was having fun. And, like, everything seemed okay. So I decided, like I wasn't honest. Like, I didn't know how to be honest then. Like, I thought it was okay that, like, to go to the doctor and get some prescription pills because I had a really bad migraine, don't you know? I didn't feel the need to tell my sponsor that I had gone to the doctor to get some prescription pills. And slowly that cycle began for me where I started taking these pills and started taking them not as prescribed. And I just couldn't get honest. And eventually I moved away. Like, my job moved me to Napa, and Napa is a great place for an alcoholic. And I started drinking again, and I got a very bad reputation in that town in a very short period of time. And I got let go of my job, and I thought it would be a great idea to move to San Francisco. And I lasted about 3 months there I was drinking. I was dancing, so I could drink this thing ever. Like, it was encouraged for me to drink every single day, and I did. And eventually, after about 3 months, I ended up with a needle in my arm again. And I didn't know how that happened. So I called my mom and I asked her for help. And she told me that she couldn't help me. And that was the first time that she ever did that. And that was the best thing she had have ever done for me. So I called my dad. And he let me move in with him. And I was driving up to Sacramento every single day because I knew people that were sober there, and I knew how to be sober there. And eventually I moved back, and I got a sponsor. But I just still couldn't get honest. Like, I couldn't get honest with myself. And eventually I got this boyfriend that used prescription pills like I did. And that's what I did for years. Like, I said I had 9 months one time loaded on pills. I would come in and out. I came in and out for a good 3 years. And I would get a couple months, and then I would go out and get a couple months and go out. And, like, pills were my thing. Like, that was my thing. Like, it was okay. It was okay. Like, I didn't drink. I didn't stick needles in my arm anymore. Like, I just took a little bit of pills. Like, no big deal. But it is. Like, it is a big deal. Like, when you're hiding it and you're not taking it as prescribed. My last drunk, within a week, I had a needle in my arm, and I was done. I was done. I was completely beaten down, and I was willing to do whatever it took. Whatever it took. I didn't have a job at that time, and my answer to everything was yes. Like, do you want to go to a meeting? Yes. Do you want to go run errands with me? Yes. Do you want to go outreach this whatever meeting? Yes. Do you want to work some steps? Yes. You know, whatever it took, and I did it, and I worked the steps with my sponsor, and working the 12 steps sober, because I worked the 12 steps loaded many times, but working them sober is a whole different thing, and what that did for me, ship with this higher power that is indescribable. I always cry when I talk about God. It's like, I feel God so strongly, and, like, I know, like, through, like, looking back on my past, like, God has always been there for me. no matter what, God has always had my back. I've always been taken care of. And that's not me, that's God. And so, like, I love God, man. You know? And so I had, about a year of sobriety, I started getting really sick. And they didn't really know what was wrong with me. And I was getting all these tests done at the doctor, and it turns out that I had a bad gallbladder and it needed to be taken out. And I was scared. Like, I was really scared to, like, have surgery in sobriety, and the doctor told me that it was highly suggested that I take pain medication to recover from that. And, like, that was my thing. Like, I didn't want to do that. Like, I was so scared of relapsing. And I didn't want to withdraw again. Like, I didn't want that in my body. And so, like, what I did is I talked to people. Like, I talked to, like, people that have gone through surgery in sobriety and have had to take pain medication in sobriety and not relapse over it. And, like, my sponsor has always told me, or she told me then, why do alcoholics have to be in any more pain than normal people? And, like, I talked to Danica, who's a nurse, and she was the one that, like, talked to me, like, made it okay for me to, like, take this medication, like, she told me, like my body needs to recover, and if my body is an intense amount of pain, it's not going to recover the way that it's supposed to. And so, like, I went through with the surgery, and I took the pain medication, and the thing that I did that made it okay for me is I talked about it. Like, I wasn't afraid to talk about it. I talked about it with everyone. Any time I had, my roommate was a methadone counselor, which was really helpful for me. So she held on to my pill bottle for me, and she gave it to me at the appropriate time, and I took everything as prescribed. And any time I was going to take a pill, I told someone, like, hey, like, I'm, like, it's time for me to take a pill. I'm in pain. Like, let me check in with you. Like, let me check my motives here. And I had to be super aware and super sensitive to everything that I was doing. And just super honest, which was so hard for me. It was so hard for me in all those years. But, like, if I didn't, like, get honest, like, in the beginning of this sobriety and work the steps and have this relationship with this God that I got, like, no way I would have been able to do this. No way I would have been able to stay sober. Like, having your drug of choice in your body in sobriety is a trippy thing, man. Like, it wasn't really fun. Like, it wasn't fun, and, like, I got cut off from God. And, like, that was the hardest thing for me, is I couldn't feel God. For, like, weeks, I couldn't feel God. And, like, me and my God are so tight. You know what? But, like, and I got through it. Like, I talked to my sponsor, and, like, and it was okay for me to taper off of it and, like, not stop completely and, like, do everything the right way. Like, the way, like, it's such a big deal for us, but, like, normal people do this all the time. You know? Like, normal people, like, pain meds are nothing to them, but for, like, me, it was such a big deal. And to walk through this with, like, dignity and grace, and, like, it was hard, because, like, there's a stigma. Like, there's a stigma attached to pain medication and sobriety. And I just had to get over that. Like, I had to get over, like, what other people thought of me, and I needed to speak my truth, because I knew that my truth would save me. And it's just amazing. Like, I can't believe the woman that I am today. Like, I've come so far, and this program is so amazing. And I just love you all. That's all I got. Thank you.
Thank you, Jen. That was awesome. Now I would like to welcome our next speaker, Susan L. from Sacramento.
Hi, I'm Susan. I'm an alcoholic. Hi. So I have a sobriety date. It's March 29, 2007. I'm active in sobriety. I have a sponsor. I have sponsees, and I do service when I'm asked and even when I don't want to. And that's why I get to stay. You know what I mean? So I'll just give you a little bit of background on me. I grew up in Sacramento in a very loving household, and I never felt comfortable. And knowing what I know now, I was having panic attacks at very early ages, and I thought I was just, like, out of body experience. They wouldn't have done anything anyway, but, you know, they would have thought I was crazy, like, because I had an imaginary friend and everything. But so what happened was, you know, I got older, and I, you know, same deal that a lot of us feel in here is I never really felt like I fit in. I would, you know, go and do, be a chameleon and go into different groups and try and find my groove. And then I found alcohol, and it, I don't know if it was ever really my solution. I've been wondering that lately, but it made me feel a part of, and it made me not feel anything except for the next day when I wake up and I felt horrible and like, what did I do last night? And my friends would try and tell me, and I'd be like, nope, actually, I don't want to know, you know. And that was daily near the end of my drinking. I got sober at 25, and when I was, I'm going to rewind a little bit, when I was 20, I did a faux attempted suicide. I think I was really drunk and seeking attention and miserable and had just done some acts I wasn't very proud of, and I just wanted to get out of the situation, so I thought taking a bottle of pills would do. And and my friend ended up sticking her fist down my throat, and I threw them all up. And I thought it was just because of my drinking, you know, like I didn't want to accept that there might be something else wrong with me. Not that anything's wrong with me, but so I flew home to Sacramento. I was living in LA at the time. And I started trying out therapists. Finally, my parents were like, okay, let's try something. And I went to one lady in LA. I didn't like her at all. So I didn't go. You know, I didn't go again. And then I had moved around to a couple different cities, and the same situations were happening in every city. When I drink and when I black out, sometimes I still tried, like, to try and kill myself. And I wanted to die on a regular basis, you know? Like, the last couple years, it was almost daily. When I drank, I wanted to die, unless I had other party favors in me, and then I was kind of balanced out, you know what I mean? And I got sober because I did a serious attempted suicide in San Diego, where the I had made a phone call to my brother, who at that point didn't want anything to do with me, never answered my phone calls, never listened to his voice messages, didn't contact me anymore. And I was in and out of, apparently my blood alcohol level could have killed me on my own, but I was taking every kind of pill that we had in the house. And I called him. I don't know what I said. He told me after I got sober if I wanted to hear it, and I said absolutely not. And what happened was he listened to that message that night for some reason. It's never happened before, he said. And he called the cops, and they kicked down the door, and because he was in San Francisco, and he called San Diego, and they kicked down the door, and I don't remember much. It was really foggy. I do remember being in the ambulance for a second, and they gave me charcoal, and I said I'd rather die, and handed it back. And then I woke up in the hospital. You know, they had obviously tubed me because I was very dry, struggling to breathe, and IVs and the whole nine, and I instantly went crazy. I was like, I want to get out of here. You guys don't know what you're doing. I need to go to Mexico. Mind you, I lost my ID the previous week, so if I had gone to Mexico, I wouldn't get back. But I got so crazy that they had to strap me down and put a security guard right in front of me. And I thought it's just another day in the life of me, you know? I don't know. I didn't want to survive. I didn't want to have lived at that moment in my life. And that was March 28th of 07. And what happened was, when I was 20, I finally did find a psychiatrist that I liked in Sacramento. And I started calling her again. Well, she started realizing I had an alcohol problem, so I stopped calling her for a couple years. And then when it was starting to get really bad, I started calling her again. And so in the hospital, I was begging for my phone, because the only person I knew who to call to get me out of getting 5150'd was her, you know? And so I was screaming so much that they just gave me my phone for a second, but I had it in my leg, so they couldn't get it back. But I called her, and she called the hospital, and she said, please release her under the care of me, and I will take full responsibility. And they did not 5150 me. They let me out. I had a flight to Sacramento, like, in 3 hours. I was sickly looking. I mean, I looked like I almost died. You know what I mean? I smelled horrible. And I was like, oh, I'll just go home, and then I'll come back. I'll see you guys in a few days, you know? I can't believe I lived, and I didn't want to, but I was just trying to be like, okay, well, maybe we'll just do this again in a couple weeks, you know? And so what happened was, I didn't have my ID, so I went to the airport, and when you don't have your ID after 9/11, security's kind of tight. And I had to go through, like, three, you know, steps to get even through security, and all of them were just looking at me like, oh, my God, you know, like, this poor woman, I will never forget her face. I get through security, and I'm sitting there waiting for the plane, and she just looked at me in disgust. And that's what Jen was talking about, that incomprehensible demoralization. I was just like, and I didn't know what was wrong with me. I didn't know I had a drinking problem. And come to find out later in sobriety, I'm bipolar. And so that combo is not really going to work for me. So I flew home, and my situation with my parents was, they were in pure denial and didn't believe I was an alcoholic. But they kind of just accepted that I needed to do something. My brother kind of forced them to go, she needs to go to treatment, she needs to get help. And so it was more like, she's got an alcohol problem, there's nothing else going on, you know? And there's a huge stigma when it comes to being bipolar or having any mental illness, and I believed that stigma. Like, sure, give me some antidepressants for a while, I'm cool, you know? But no, I'm not bipolar. And so I went to treatment, and I found God, and I met a sponsor, and I did my steps, and I was still absolutely crazy. Like, one minute I'd be on cloud nine, like, party girl, the next minute I'd be like, I want to die so bad. And I didn't know what was wrong. I thought, I just am not working my program enough. You know what I mean? I need to, like, I'm just not doing the steps. I don't have a clue. Like, I just thought it was AA and my sobriety. What ended up happening is, you know, my therapist suggested I go to the psychologist who I'd seen before. They live together. They're in the same office. And so they were like, well, maybe you're bipolar. And I said, I'm absolutely not bipolar. And I was like, it's my program. And they're like, well, let's just wait and see. You get a little bit more time of sober, and we'll see, like, how your mental state is. You know, maybe you just need to dry out a little bit. Because I had DTs for 18 months. In the beginning of my sobriety. And so it was always a question of, what is it, you know? And as soon as they said bipolar, I was like, no, that's not me. I refuse. I was stubborn, and I believed that stigma of, like, you are just different. And I was so sick of being different. And then, you know, I got into a relationship, and I was going on a regular basis to see the therapist and my sponsor and doing the deal, you know, like, everything I could, but refused to take drugs, because I'm not bipolar. I'm not that girl. And I got into a relationship, and what ended up happening was he didn't do something I liked. And this was a regular basis. Like, he didn't do something like I freak out and get really pissed, and then he'd call me crazy, and I don't like that word ever anymore. There's no crazy right here, unless I say so. So he did something I didn't like. I don't remember exactly what the situation was, but I went pure manic, like beyond belief, should have been locked up immediately, threw his stuff out of the apartment, got freaked out. I was at work right after I did that. My brother works with me, and I was like, oh my God, we need to go home and change the locks. And he's like, I don't know how to change the lock. I was like, we got to change the locks. I was freaking out. He was going to go in his own our apartment and take my stuff. I mean, that's whatever. But, you know, I just was insane. It was like, I don't know what, and I couldn't stop myself. That was the thing. Like, I put that idea in my head, and I was just, I was like, no. Like, freaking out beyond belief. So we went out and bought locks in the middle of the day at work, went home, and it took us 3 hours to change the locks. So we're not very good in our family with that stuff, I guess. I called people and they were like, okay, like you changed the locks, it's all right, you know. You know, they're kind of like trying to support me, but what the heck are you doing? I was insane, and I was just I just couldn't stop myself from being super depressed and super manic. And it wasn't like a day of manic, it was like a month. And then it'd be a month of being wanting to just die again, you know? And I was just like, what's going on? And so after that little situation happened and he moved out, and I went to the doctor and I kind of explained what I did, and he's like, you're bipolar and we need to take care of this. And I was so desperate because I didn't know what else to do. I finally accepted the fact that I am bipolar and it's okay, you know? It's a long process to get on the correct level, and everyone's different. And it was a process for me to get to the correct level that I'm at today. And it was really hard. I had to do a lot of work with my sponsor, and she could relate to me. And that's what I needed. And it was okay that I needed to take, medication. And it says in the book, if you need to do that, then you need to do that. And that's okay. And if I had heard that maybe in early sobriety, I might have done it earlier, you know. I might have taken the stigma away for me, but this was my path and this is what happened. Funny story about changing those locks. I locked myself out because I didn't put the keys on my keychain. And the plumber was outside because he needed to fix the toilet, and he was not happy. And so he just twisted not a screwdriver, but those wrench things. He took the wrench and just twisted the doorknob a little bit, and while I was open, we didn't put the lock on right. And so I never actually even changed. Well, I ended up changing those locks back, but I didn't change them immediately. I just started locking the gate door. But what has happened for me is I got on the right medication, and I'm at a place where, like, I might have a moment here and there, but I feel okay today. Like, I stub my toe, I don't scream at the world. I go, ow. You know what I mean? Like, I've had a rough couple of years in the last bit of my sobriety, and part of it was that someone close to me brought the stigma back, and I believed it. And I was like, I am different, and no one's gonna love me because I'm bipolar, you know? And it really sunk in, and I was like, well, maybe I should just not take my medication, you know? And
And thank God I have the women and the men in this program and my sponsor around me. And I'm so close to them all because they walked me through it, you know? And I felt okay. And there's definitely times in my sobriety where things have happened and I misplaced God is a better way of putting it, for a while. And the wanting to die came back, you know? And I went to my psychiatrist and we reevaluated. And I see him on a monthly basis, and I keep up on my spiritual AA basis, and I also keep up on my mental health. And my life is amazing because of it. I couldn't really get things together. I couldn't really handle life, even in sobriety. And I'm working through getting rid of the stigma again, you know? I'm learning to love myself just as I am. And I am lovable, and I know that for myself, and I don't care what anyone else thinks about it. And I have God, and everything that happened exactly the way it was supposed to be for me. Of course, I would like to say, I wish I had done this earlier, and I would have been sane sooner, but it all came down to acceptance of what I choose to do with my life, who I am. You know, I was born this way. In my belief, I was born this way. Nothing made me an alcoholic. Nothing made me bipolar. You know, mental illness does run in my family, and we all take care of ourselves. And I was the example for that for the rest of them. And it's, I don't know, life's so good. And I can get sad and be okay. And the other tricky thing with having mental illness and being an alcoholic is when I get sad or I get angry or I still have manic, but they are much shorter. And I don't know if it's my program or if it's my mental illness. You know, it's like, what is it, you know? And over time and really working in both areas of my dual diagnosis, you know, I have learned 95% of the time what it is. I can tell when my physical body is having the mental illness, and I can tell when my spiritual fitness is absolutely not there. And that's because of watching people, asking for help, being open, because I never really heard, you know, mental illness be talked about a lot in meetings. If someone brought it up, some old timers would have some opinions about it, from my experience. And so I just would always keep my mouth shut. And so now I just try and be really open with, this is who I am. And like, I'm an example. And so I try to remember that on a daily basis. Like, if someone's struggling, like, I'm absolutely willing to be like, I understand. And like, if someone, one of my friend's sponsees or one of their friends was like, there, can I give them your number? And I'm absolutely, you know, my life's amazing, even when it doesn't look amazing. And I handle life with as much grace and dignity as I can on a daily basis. And I don't know, I owe it all to Alcoholics Anonymous. I owe it all to the fellowship. I owe it all to God and my God. It's mine. And I'm really glad where I am. I'm glad that I don't want to murder people, and I'm glad I don't want to kill myself. It's been a while since I've wanted to do that, which is nice. And so I just want to thank you all for coming out. And like, if you know, you're struggling with that or anything, like, if you want to talk, I'm available. And like, it's okay to have dual diagnosis, and it's okay. And it's, you know, I'm grateful for my reality today. And so thank you all.
Thank you, Susan. And finally, please help me welcome our last speaker,
Danji C. from Sacramento.
Hi, my name is Danji. I'm an alcoholic. So we were at a business meeting, and Wacky Paul gave us this panel, and they offered us the opportunity to talk about religion. And I was sitting at the meeting, and I raised my hand. I was like, I want to talk about religion. That's going to be a good one right here, you know. And so I was sitting and thinking about, like, how do I want to approach the subject? Because it's so, like, controversial. So, like, to be, like, to have, like, a little breaker, I was going to bring a gong and, like, hit it, like, the incense, and ask for all the spirits and everything to, like, welcome this, like, you know, this topic without it being too uncomfortable. But, you know, the reality is when it comes down to beliefs and, like, a way of going about spirituality, it's a personal thing. And people, you know, I know even for myself, like, I get a little uncomfortable when somebody tells me that if I'm not living my life this way, then that means I'm this type of person and I'm going to be damned, you know? And when I was younger, I had gotten in trouble with the law. And so, of course, like a lot of us, you know, we do that, like, God, please help me. And so I dove into religion, and I enjoyed it because it gave me a different idea on how to live my life, similar to the way Alcoholics Anonymous has, you know, given me this way of staying sober. But what they showed me is to come to understand for myself, like, how to go about, like, you know, getting into the book and then, you know, deciding things. So, you know, I would sit there for hours, and I, of course, it's not recovery. So I'm sitting there like, God, it's good. You know, look at this scripture right here. And then I have my friends like, if you don't stop, you're going to hell. Like, you know, it just don't work. You know what I'm saying? And, but yeah, I believed it because there were certain things that I stopped doing. Like, I stopped stealing stuff because that's bad. You know, I stopped lying because that's not good either. But I could not stop smoking and drinking. There was no way. How else would I get in touch with the spirit? You know what I mean? Like, and not only that, it's like, I don't know about you, but those words just seem so mystical and, like, touching if you're smoking a joint and drinking a beer. I don't know about if you can relate, but it's true for me. So, of course, you know, there's nothing that was going to keep me sober and that was going to last. So, of course, I strayed from that. But what happened, though, was it gave me a different way on looking at spirituality and also having a level of, like spirit. I always think rigidity, but it's not. It's like, what is that? Discipline. You know, having a spiritual discipline and a level of accountability towards, you know, something that is greater than myself that is showing me how to live my life through a law. I had that desire to want to live a spiritual and a disciplined life. But I'm an alcoholic, you know, and I'm going to drink. And I'm not going to be moral because that doesn't fit in the lifestyle. Hello, it's like, you know, I need to steal some shit and I need to go hustle somebody. Like, I can't be doing that in Christian at the same time. Like, that just doesn't work out. So I did a lot of stuff to kill that God conscience that I had received at a young age. And when I came to the program and I was going through the book, I was very apprehensive on the religious part or just the spirituality that the program offers. And I remember reading Re-Agnostics, and it talks about every man, woman, and child having that inherent sense of God. You know, that hit me because that was true from when I was very young. I don't know about you, man, but, like, I've always felt like there is something greater. I've always felt like there is something that was supposed to show me a better way of life because this shit ain't working out. Like, you know, the grown-ups in my life, that ain't right. Like, you know, and so when I read that, I understood it as, like, every time I was little or every time a situation was happening and I just had that inherent sense that this is not the way life is supposed to be, that's God showing me that there's something greater if only I just allow myself to be open to it. So I've got back into my religion when I got sober. And it worked out. It was great, you know, because I was sitting there and I was getting back in the book the same way that I used to when I was 14, except I wasn't smoking a joint. You know, I was sitting there, like, really being open to the discipline that the religion I was choosing offered me. And I was able to relate that to the book because, you know, the literature has things that, like, coincide with the religion I was choosing at that time. Like, you know, faith without works is a dead faith. I got that. Like, you know, I understood that. And then when they took, like, certain prayers and had that, like, you know, like, just offer that spirit of change, like, I understood that. And so I took the next step, and I gave my will and my life over to my religion. And I was, like, 1 year sober, and at that time, it wasn't that I was trying to serve God, but it was I was trying to serve people. Because I still felt that sense of like, worthlessness, because I hadn't yet worked out the spiritual malady that comes from, you know, living a life of drugs and alcohol. You know what I'm saying? So I would be going, and like, we have service, and I picked a religion that was going to make me do some shit. So, you know, they gave me a briefcase and, like, sent me off on my way to share the good word. And so I was doing that, you know, and I was knocking on doors and stuff like that, spreading the good word. And I related to it. I really did. But I was dying inside, because I knew that when I got home, everything was different, because I did not know how to have appropriate relationships with men. So I was having sex with people I should not have been even dealing with. I was kind of living a double life in AA and in my religion. You know, I would be this one way, and then I would be like this one this way, you know, in the rooms. And that shit right there, I don't know about you, but that's purgatory. You know, trying to apply spiritual principle in one way and then living completely opposite. No, that was fucked up. And so what had happened is I asked to be removed from the religion that I had chose to serve. And it was very scary for me, because then I didn't know what am I supposed to do now? What now? You know, because I was very anti, like, you know, pretty pillow, incense, and quietness. You know, that didn't work for me. I tried it. And so I was kind of like, oh, my gosh, what do I do? And so I started to just find those people in the program that speak the language of the spirit, you know. And through working the steps, it has shown me what I was really searching for in my religion. But couldn't, because I was serving people rather than my God. And so when I sat down and I was doing my fourth step and getting my fifth step and becoming honest with myself, something opened up to me, and I was able to see why I was attracted to religion in the first place. And it's because they offered me a way of life that I had never considered before, because nobody who was bringing me up, or, you know, or the people that I was around, like, ever displayed that that's the way to be. I don't know if that makes sense. Basically, what I mean is, like, having a spiritually disciplined and you know, accountable life. And so today, what religion looks like for me is, you know, just a group of people who give us specific directions, and you know, I'm still struggling with, like, what do I want to choose? Because you know, spirituality works for me, but spiritual discipline is what keeps me here and sane. And you know, they talk about it in our literature about how we need to be quick to find where organized religion is right. And so I started to think about, like, those fundamental laws, the universal law, like, do unto those as you want others to do unto you. You know, what you put out, you get back tenfold. Like, I started to really just focus in on that, and then just look at how every other organized religion kind of had the same teaching. So in that way, I was able to reconnect with something greater than myself that had nothing to do with, like, a specific way on going in with the Spirit, but more like what the Spirit is, like, guiding mankind to do, you know? And when it talked about that inherent sense of God in every man, woman, and child, I looked at it as, like, every time that I came in contact with somebody and I had the utmost respect for, and the only thing I wanted to do is make sure that they had everything in the world and to become a healthy person. To me, that was God. That was God showing me how to live my life on a spiritual way, just without giving me a direct command. This is how you're going to go about doing it. So, I don't know. It's kind of like, I think I was kind of just trying to figure out, like, do I stay here and share about, like, you know, how religion is important, and that if you don't go about getting some, that you're not going to get this thing, you know? And for me, that's not true, because I bought into the religion, and, you know, it worked out for me. But the thing that really keeps me yearning to want to search in every aspect of spirituality, whether it be going to a sweat lodge, or maybe even sitting in some kind of monastery, whatever it may be, like, to keep my ear open for that, you know, that direction is the most important. And I think what I wanted to do is just read that little, there's this one paragraph in We Agnostics that is so powerful to me. Because it's like, when I wasn't able to go back to my religion, is because I was sitting there feeling like they were intolerant of the person that I am, when really I was intolerant with what they were just basically asking me to do, and that's live, like, a good life. Kind of like in Alcoholics Anonymous, when my sponsor tells me that, you know, I need to do a four-step and get a fifth-step and have a power greater than myself that's going to help me change my ways, like, my first reaction is, like, hell to the no. Like, what am I going to do then? You know? Like, whatever. And so I could choose to look at, you know, the proposals that you guys are giving me, like, you know, if you stop doing this, then you're going to get this, instead of looking at that as, like, oh, no, that's, you know, that will make me feel fear and uncomfort. Instead, it's like, okay, I'm going to go ahead and do that because homegirl just did. And so, you know, I'm going to just go ahead and look at it as, you know, I'm going to grow through pain. But anytime that I allow a prejudice or just, you know, my own uniqueness to say, like, no, that's not going to work for me, I shut the door on the possibility, you know? And so I was just thinking, I'm just going to read this little paragraph because it has so much power for me. It's kind of like how I go, you know, not only with how I'm going to choose to, like, take some spiritual direction, but also, like, my relationship with Alcoholics Anonymous and the path that they're offering me, you know, which is a sober one, you know. And so it's right here. It goes, "We who have traveled this dubious path beg you to lay aside prejudice, even against organized religion. We have learned that whatever the human frailty of various faiths may be, those faiths have given purpose and direction to millions. People of faith have a logical idea of what life is all about." Now, I had a little bit of a problem with that, because some of that shit is, no, that's no logic. There is no logic in some of that shit that y'all doing. But, you know, by me doing that, it just totally, like, you know, I just allowed myself to be prejudiced. So those things, the stuff that I'm like, no, 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 you know, I have to take a look at that, because, you know, what's really going on? You know, where is that prejudice really stemming from? So, it goes on to say, "Actually, we used to have no reasonable conception whatever. We used to amuse ourselves by cynical dissecting spiritual beliefs and practices when we might have observed that many spiritual-minded persons of all races, colors, and creeds were demonstrating a degree of stability and happiness and usefulness which we should have sought ourselves. Instead, we looked at the human defect of these people and sometimes use their shortcomings as a basis of wholesale condemnation. We talked of intolerance while we were intolerant ourselves. That's the part that really strikes me. We talk of intolerance when we ourselves are intolerant, you know? And so we miss the reality and the beauty of the forest because we were diverted by the ugliness of some of its trees. We never gave the spiritual side of life a fair hearing. And so, you know, the last conversation, I've been asking a lot of y'all, if you're my friend, you know, I already asked you, like, what's your, like, view and experience with religion. And, you know, one of the last people that I talked to were just saying that it's important for us to be as useful as we can for the newcomer. And that some newcomers come in with religion. And that if I choose, I could go ahead and be open to every single belief out there and maybe even crack up open a little bit of their literature or maybe even get some knowledge on what they're really trying to achieve so that then if an alcoholic that comes into the rooms who has a religious basis and that's their tradition and that's what they're going to stand by, I'll be able to serve them because I've taken that loving kindness to try to understand what the, you know, where they're coming from. And by doing that, I become more open to the possibility that maybe something greater than myself will reveal them, you know, will give me the strength to live sober one more day at a time, you know, and to give me a hope. And you know, that right there is what keeps me striving to get closer to the divine. That's my shit, the divine. You will hear me. I will be like, the divine spirit, please bless us with the need that we have to walk through this day, honey, because it is looking ugly. Like, you know what I'm saying? But what it comes down to is I love that we have free reign with whichever way we choose to go about spirituality and religion. We have that free reign to do it. And for me, it's like, I'm going to take that opportunity. And, you know, they told me that I will cease fighting everything, everyone, everything and everyone. So if that's going to be true for me, then I just need to cut it out and just see what's really going on. So, you know, I hope that imparted some kind of hope. You know what I'm saying? If not, you can pray about it. So my name is God. my name is Deandre, and I'm an alcoholic.
Thanks so much, you guys. You all did such a good job. The Wacky Pop 15 host committee would like to thank all the conference participants and attendees for making this weekend possible and magical. The next panel meeting in this room will begin at 4:30 p.m., and the topic is relapse. Please help me thank our speakers and reader again. And after a moment of silence for the alcoholic who still suffers, Carolyn will lead us out with a prayer of her choice.